On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Ryan Curry about theological aesthetics. So we cover all sorts of topics like what does it mean to have a theological aesthetic? How does culture and art relate? What does it mean to have a theological aesthetic that's based on the theology of the cross? Why is beauty related to glory? What does it mean for the spiritual sense to transform the physical sense? And how does this all relate to something like the beatific vision? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that is dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And as we do with all of our podcasts, if you're new to listening, we try to encourage and cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. And so that typically looks like just being open and honest and having frank discussions with others whom we may disagree with or agree with on a wide range of topics, and being open to being corrected, but also being open to saying, I think you're wrong here. And that's what makes it really, really fun. We think it's a safe space to be robustly confessional and to be happy about it, but to also be open and charitable toward other people's thoughts and ideas. Now, on today's episode, I'm thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. Ryan Curry. So Dr. Curry has done a lot of work on theological aesthetics. He wrote his dissertation on this and has done a significant amount of thinking on it. And I would guess if there is a list of the favorite sort of ammunition pieces for Roman Catholics or Eastern Orthodox against Protestants, this is one of the top ones. It's got to be. It's up there to where they love to say, Protestants, man, they have no theology of beauty. Look at their churches. They look like Pizza Huts. They look like strip malls. They are in strip malls. They don't have cathedrals. They don't have any sense of awe or wonder or beauty. And yet here we are with Ryan, who's done a significant amount of work on theological aesthetics as a Protestant. So I'm looking forward to this, to discussing the topic in general. Before we jump in, Ryan, tell me a little bit about yourself, and then I want to know what was it that really piqued your interest and drew you to thinking about this topic in particular.
Yeah, so thanks again for having me. I've been a teacher overseas for the last few years, since 2015. We first were in Mongolia teaching at a Bible college and was there for a few years, and then moved to Liberia in West Africa. And in January, I'll be moving to the UAE with my family to be teaching at a seminary there. So that's a short bio on who I am. What led me to study Baltazar at first was actually I did my MDiv and THM at Bethlehem College and Seminary. And so I studied under John Piper, and John Piper's Christian Hedonism was really influential. Just Piper describes his ministry as seeing, savoring, and showing the supreme worth and beauty of God. So as I thought about what Piper was saying and really reflected and just wanted to study more about God's beauty in particular. And some of the things that Piper was saying that I was starting to wonder, okay, where does this fit in systematic theology? Like, not a lot of people talk about the beauty of God. So that got me on this rabbit trail of looking into the history of the theology of beauty, and led me to Baltazar, who I think has a lot of similar things to say, surprisingly, to Piper, and a lot of very, very different things, obviously, but it was really Piper that led me to Baltazar in the first place.
Okay, perfect. So let's go ahead and start with a baseline definition or a basic definition of what theological aesthetics is, at least in your mind, in your opinion. And then I'd love to hear, as a follow-up, how do things like art and culture relate, and how does that really fit into the vision of theological aesthetics?
Yeah, so what is theological aesthetics? And that's actually a big problem within theological aesthetics, because there's been a whole lot of ambiguity on what is this thing that we're talking about. What is theological aesthetics? And a lot of times in the field of theological aesthetics, you see people reference Baltazar in particular, but what you realize is that Balthasar kind of really popularized theological aesthetics, but then it shifted to a whole different ball game from what Balthasar developed as theological aesthetics. It really shifted into more of a discussion of art and theology. And specifically, there's two basic streams in theological aesthetics. One is the more Balthasarian type of theological aesthetics, and one is the more approach that was developed by Karl Rahner. And so Rahner's approach is much more, getting into the weeds a little bit here, but it's much more liberal. It's much more classically liberal because it's based on his, what he calls the supernatural existential, and really kind of confuses the creator and the creature. And so Rahner would say that he can look at art and see God. He can see the infinity of God in that art. So Balthasar's approach was actually much more different. He had a stronger creator-creature distinction. And so Balthasar had a stronger creator-creature distinction and is much more orthodox, really. So to the question of how does culture and art relate, that is it's actually what Balthasar is saying that theological aesthetics is not. It's not about art and culture. It's about more, who is God and what has he done?
Okay, so this is good. So before we move on, I'd love for you to tease out a little bit on Balthasar. So I think we've mentioned him several times already, and he features significantly in your dissertation, but I would guess or imagine that, 60-70% of our listeners or regular listeners are not very familiar with him and his writings, his context, his history. They may know his name, but they don't really know much about him. So give me a little bit of the brief bio on who he is, what he's writing about, what are his influences, those sort of things, to help us place a little bit of the context for the work that you're doing.
Yeah. So actually just my mother-in-law, she was joking that that I spent so much time writing on someone from Harry Potter or from Lord of the Rings. Because people think, okay, Balthasar, isn't that one of the three wise men or something like that? So especially in Protestant circles and in evangelical circles, especially, where people are like, you're studying who? Like, and just have no idea. So he's actually considered one of the most influential Catholic theologians of the 20th century. So he would be considered one of the resourcement theologians, so really influenced by de Lubac. And later he was friends with Joseph Ratzinger and Pope John Paul II. And so really in that stream of thought, kind of a centrist, when you think of more the liberal side of Catholicism and then the far conservative side of Catholicism, he was more centrist in his approach to theology. But he was born in 1905 in Switzerland. And so he grew up in Switzerland and went to school in Zurich. And he actually, his study was, I guess not surprisingly, given his topic, was in literature and in music. So he wasn't, he often boasted that he wasn't an official theologian, but even though he really was. But you can see how his interest in music and literature really influenced and was brought into his theological aesthetic. So as a centrist, maybe you could say, in Catholicism, what he was really trying to do was see how, like, the modern questions, the questions of modernity, could be answered from an Orthodox standpoint. So his critique of the more conservative branches of Catholicism, and especially the neo-scholastic, neo-Thomist branches of theology, was, he says, yes, these These branches are answering the questions that modernity asks, but they're answering it in such a way that no one's listening. And so what he tries to do is, it's really an apologistic approach to theology for the modern world. So he was accused of being a liberal by many of those more conservative, but then also considered way too conservative for people who were to the left of him.
Well, I've got all sorts of funny jokes that I think I could insert at this point based on the spectrum he inhabits. But I want to know a little bit about his critique against Protestantism. What is that? What's going on there?
Yeah, so his critique was really, like you said at the beginning of the podcast, that Protestants have no theological account of beauty. They have no theology of beauty. And his two main villains that he really goes after are Luther and Kierkegaard. So for Luther, what he says, and surprise, surprise, right? Obviously, the bad guy is Luther when you're coming at it from a Catholic perspective. But what he said about Luther is that Luther developed this cold methodological stance that just gave birth to all sorts of schism after schism, and just proliferated this cold methodological stance that was always at war with others. And so what he says is in his typical rhetoric is that Protestantism bears the indelible mark of Cain. And so that's pretty much theological smack talk. If you're going to say, man, that person and that group of people bears the indelible mark of Cain, it's a pretty big critique. And he says what Luther did was he transformed evangelism or the gospel into Protestantism. So instead of the good news, it's now a gospel of protest. And so what he then goes on to say is that Kierkegaard was really the one who furthered this in his stages or his spheres of existence. And he said that Kierkegaard was the one who really opposed the aesthetic to the religious and the ethical, or the ethical and the religious, and interiorized the faith in such a way that it cut off beauty from all of the rest of theology and religion itself. So his critique especially is that Protestantism has cut off beauty from theology. It's cut off beauty from religion. But it's interesting though, because usually what we do, and I think evangelicals have heard that critique of Catholicism, like you meant that, like you mentioned that we meet in Pizza Huts or elementary schools, and where's our physical appreciation for physical beauty. But what Balthazar says is actually that Protestants have, whenever they talk about beauty, they always talk about a beauty of how does art and theology intersect. So that's what Protestants always talk about. So it's almost counterintuitive, because people usually hear Balthazar's critique and they say, well, what we have to do is to make more beautiful things or have more beauty in evangelical churches or use more art and worship. But that's actually not what Balthazar's saying. He's saying, no, what the Protestants need to do is they need to develop a theology of beauty.
Yeah, so I don't know if you have the answer to this question, but I started to think as you were talking and started making some connections in my head, and I don't know if they're accurate or not, so I want to ask. So you've mentioned main interlocutors are those like Luther and Kierkegaard. He goes to school in Zurich. Does he interact significantly at all with those like Zwingli or Calvin? I mean, Zwingli obviously there in Zurich. Why not? What's going on there?
Yeah, he does. So the thing about Balthazar is he interacts with basically everyone. and he's such a prolific writer that he does it in such a way, like he's even though he says Luther and Protestantism bears the indelible mark of Cain. He's pretty generous overall, and he has a lot of rhetoric, but he's generous overall. I can't remember of any actual interaction with Zwingli, so that's a good point. The little that I've read of him with Calvin, it's pretty negative, but it's mostly mediated through his interaction with Karl Barth, because Barth was very influential in his theology. So it was limited, but yeah, mediated through Barth.
Yeah, so I guess in my mind, I'm just thinking, if you want to have an opponent, or at least an easier opponent, you wouldn't go to Luther. You go to someone like Zwingli, who's much more radical and much stronger, especially in an ascetic sort of mindset.
Yeah, on some things, like I think Zwingli was more open to using the philosophers than Luther was. And so, like, that's a big thing that in Balthasar's project is he's very positive about using Plato and philosophers. And so I think he would have appreciated a lot that what Zwingli said about the philosophers.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact quote, but I think Zwingli says something along the lines of ushering in Moses right alongside Plato or something like that,
exactly.
Where there's really no distinction whatsoever.
Yeah, and that's Balthasar. So Balthasar he'd be there for that.
So you have some sections in the dissertation writing on aesthetics and the theology of the cross, and I'm sure those who are familiar with the categories and the terms are probably going to make a recognition to say, oh, theology of the cross, Luther? So is this supposed to be a Luther-inspired argument? Is this drawing on Luther material? Or is it completely distinct and it just happens to be an overlap of terminology?
Yeah, so what I did in the dissertation was just tried to show that Luther especially had a good contribution to a theology of beauty. And there's actually a lot of work recently on Luther's theological aesthetic and what that means. And so what I wanted to do was show how Protestants and even evangelicals have a theological aesthetic. It's just slightly underdeveloped. And so the thing with Balthasar is, and my main critique of him and his theological aesthetic is, he's got a really underdeveloped theology of sin. And I wish you would have heard Luther's theology of sin and the bondage of the will more, because for Balthasar, beauty in creation is basically an unqualified good. And the difference with Luther and what Luther did, especially in the Heidelberg disputation in 1518, is he shows how even the best gifts of God are idolatrous and can be used in the worst way if they're in the hands of a sinful humanity that hasn't passed through the cross, hasn't passed through the judgment of the cross and in faith in Christ. And then Luther makes the point that once sin is dealt with, once we as sinners have passed through the cross, then, and he says this in Thesis 24 in that Heidelberg disputation, that if we don't do that, we can misuse the gifts of God in the worst way. And so what that also implies on the positive side is the way to receive the good gifts of God is to first pass through the cross. And so what he would say to Balthasar's approach is, Balthasar's approach to beauty is inherently idolatrous, because what Balthasar is saying is beauty basically can redeem us. And Balthasar had a lot of things to say about, say, Karl Rahner's Anonymous Christian, where basically in Rahner's approach, everyone's a Christian. And so Balthasar really critiques that, but Balthasar himself actually ends up in the same position, because beauty, in effect, reveals Christ. And the problem is not sin. In Balthasar's retelling of it, sin is basically amnesia, that we've forgotten what Christ did. And so this leads to his universalism and all sorts of things, where I think he's forgotten the central place of the gospel, which is what the theology of the cross really is, that no, we have to pass through the cross, through the judgment of the cross. Christ has to bear our curse, and it's only then that we can see and enjoy beauty rightly, once we pass through the cross.
Yeah, okay. So one of the things you work on significantly, or at least you develop quite a bit in this dissertation, is the concepts of beauty and glory. I guess that is partly theology, but beauty and glory are the topics and the ideas. So you work this out quite a bit, contrasting, I guess, comparing them and sort of intertwining them together. Is this something that's completely unique to you, original to you, or is this something you're drawing on various sources that are sort of like random pieces of rubble and you're building something out of it? How does that work?
Yeah, so this was one of the things that really interests me in the first place in studying this, and just thinking about, okay, what is the difference between glory and beauty? And even with Piper, he oftentimes will use beauty and glory interchangeably. And I think you see that as I looked through just popular evangelical writings. I think that's a common thread, that they use beauty and glory interchangeably. So just trying to tease out, what is the difference between glory and beauty? But you also see in the tradition and through theologians, everyone approaches it slightly differently. So Athanasius approaches it differently than say John of Damascus, and Augustine approaches it in a different way than Luther would. But a lot of times it seems like when theologians talked about glory, they were oftentimes talking about an essential attribute of God, like Bart especially, I think, really takes the tradition and develops it well, and he says that glory is the sum of God's manifold perfections. So it's the sum of who He is, and he brings simplicity in there and just says, okay, glory is just who God is, the sum of His manifold perfections. But when we think about beauty, the beauty of God, different theologians developed it differently. So like Edwards and Aquinas were very similar in how they developed beauty. But Bart says, you know, we should really think of beauty as a subset of glory. So it's like the external part of glory that draws, woos, and attracts a sinful humanity. So I think there's been recent work by a guy named Jonathan King who talks about beauty as a quality of glory. And I really like how King says that. It's a quality of glory. But there is, and that's how I would end up saying, I think that's the best way to say it. But there's a whole lot of ambiguity just because of the interrelationship between glory and beauty. And I'd say they're the two sides of the same coin. Glory is that objective quality of God's worth, his kavod, his weightiness, and then beauty is like Bart saying, it's that quality that draws us or attracts us to God's glory. So they're referring to the same thing, but one is talking about the objective side and one is talking about the subjective side.
Well, you've managed to usher in both Edwards and Aquinas on the same team, so I think you've managed to probably make everybody mad from all sides. Make of that whatever you will. Now, you mentioned John of Damascus, or I've seen other people say like John of Damascene, and I'm going to be honest with you, I have no idea what that means or why he would be called that. I'm probably stupid. Apparently, that is a very, very likely solution. So I'm totally open to being corrected if you shouldn't be calling him John of Damascus or something else.
I mean, I'm in the same boat. I just say John of Damascus. Yeah, so I think you're good.
So he has his whole defense of icons along with the seventh Ecumenical Council. So how does that sort of logic really factor into your account, impact your account, influence it?
Yeah, so I do spend some time developing his work in relation to theological aesthetics, and mostly as kind of a flip side of Augustine. So, for example, Augustine is extremely positive when it comes to material beauty, but he always has this suspicion of material beauty and wants to get away from it. And for example, art and especially theater for Augustine was you didn't touch that. And a lot of creative beauty, he was rightly concerned about what Luther would later develop as that bondage to sin, that we're going to use beauty in the wrong way. So he had a high nervousness when it comes to created beauty and the arts. John of Damascus, on the flip side, he really develops Athanasius's arguments about the incarnation of Christ and how God created the world. Material is therefore good. And so John of Damascus is kind of like the flip side, where I think you need both. You need both Augustine's nervousness about misusing created beauty, but you also need John of Damascus's really glorification of matter. He says, I venerate matter because Christ became flesh and Christ became matter. And so I think that John of Damascus goes too far in his defense of the icons. I think icons are idolatrous, but where I think he can help us in his theology is just reaffirming the wonder of material creation, and specifically that art is helpful, that art is a good thing. And that's specifically an argument that he developed from Athanasius.
So this is a little bit off topic, so you can punt it if you want. Might be a little bit of a spicy take. I don't know. You tell me. But as you've been talking and I've been thinking, why is it that it seems to be that anyone who's interested in aesthetics or art ends up being more on the liberal end of the spectrum? I mean, where are the conservatives who say, yes, I want to champion and care about art?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that Balthazar can really help us with that. And because really what Balthazar says, and all those guys, all those more liberal evangelicals would really pay a whole lot of lip service to Balthazar, but they're really the ones that I think have no idea what Balthazar is saying. So Balthazar is really, he valued the performative arts and the more dynamic arts, like drama and music. And he was actually very sympathetic to iconoclastic tendencies. And so where I think Balthazar can help evangelicals is to see, so for Balthazar, the pinnacle of beauty is Jesus Christ himself. So Jesus is the self-showing of God. So the transcendentals that Balthazar goes after, they all focus on and reveal Jesus Christ. And so what Balthazar says is by fixing our gaze on Jesus, that pinnacle of beauty, Jesus himself, it transforms our lives so that we live beautiful lives. And so in Balthazar's account, the beauty that he's after is the beauty of the Christian life. And he says the highest form of beauty in the world is the Christian form. And what he's saying is the Christian form is, like C.S. Lewis would say, it's a little Christ walking around in the world. And so he's much more all about the dynamic of the lives rather than the physical beautiful cathedrals, beautiful art. And how I think that a theology of cross even more complements that is that, look, if you are a person, an artist, say, who is a theologian of the cross, you've taken your art and your very self, and you've repented of your sin, and you've passed through the cross, and you're creating art that is, by the worldly standards, it will never be anywhere near the elite art. It'll be considered ugly, but that art in and of itself is honoring and glorifying to God. So it's really not about the physical object itself. It's about who we are as Christians.
So you talk about the spiritual sense transforming the physical sense. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah. So Balthazar has a lot to say about the spiritual sense. And there's a good work that's recently been done in the last 10 years by Mark McEnroy on Balthazar and the spiritual sense. And so what Balthazar actually talked about the spiritual senses, and what he meant was that the spiritual senses, and so this is where it gets a little bit convoluted, and I disagree with Balthazar, but he would say basically everyone has the spiritual senses. So you can see God in the beauty of creation. So your eyes, for example, when you see a beautiful tree or the ocean, you can in effect see God. So it's a spiritual sense. It's the faculty for spiritual sense perception, and likewise with touch. Like you can touch something soft, and that reveals something spiritual. So from a Protestant perspective, that simply doesn't work, because we say, okay, we are, yes, there's common grace, and true things are revealed about God through our spirit, our physical senses. But we also say we are dead in sin. Like it doesn't, we believe in Romans 1, where we say, okay, yes, we take those things and we, so we would say we trade the truth of God for a lie, but we also trade the beauty of God for a lie. We substitute physical beauty and make it into an idol, rather than following after the true beauty of God. So the spiritual sense, I think you could just point to it exegetically and say Ephesians chapter 1, where the eyes of the heart are opened so that you can see God, and 2 Corinthians 3 and 4, where you can see the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And so you have this spiritual sense where you can apprehend or see the beauty of God through faith. And then there's a second step to that. So you have this spiritual sense that you can see and perceive the beauty of God in the face of Jesus Christ in a way that those who don't know God cannot, but we can see him. And so that spiritual sense transforms our physical senses so that now we can see the beauty of God in everything. So now that we've been regenerated, now that we have this spiritual sense, now we can see the glory of God in creation. We can see the beauty of God in creation. And so there's Edwards scholarship has a lot of talk about the spiritual sense as well. And there's different approaches. People ask the question, okay, does the spiritual sense have nothing to do with the physical senses, or is it kind of like a hand in glove sort of thing, where the spiritual sense guides the physical senses so that we can perceive God through creation? And I think the best answer is the spiritual sense, our sight of Christ, our being drawn to the beauty of Christ, transforms how we see and perceive and hear and touch and taste and smell, and so that we can truly see the beauty and glory of God in all of creation through our physical senses.
Okay, so is the spiritual sense then some sort of like sixth sense then?
Yeah. So that's actually one of the questions. Is it a sixth sense, or is it or it doesn't have nothing to, so the three possibilities are, is it a sixth sense? Does it have nothing to do with the physical senses, or does it inhabit the five senses or the physical senses of the body? And so I think it's best to say that the spiritual sense transforms it. So it's not like, so if you think of it in the like arguments of, okay, grace and nature. So how does grace relate to nature? And so I would say that grace, the spiritual sense, relates to nature, the physical senses, in that it transforms them. So if you think about like the Garden of Eden, why did God create these senses? Why did God create sight and smell and touch? And I think it's because he wanted us to perceive his beauty and be drawn to his beauty and his glory through creation. And so you get this beautiful thing in poetry, like Milton, for example, in Paradise Lost, he talks about when God speaks, a beautiful aroma fills the air. And so God created our physical senses in order to reveal more of him. And so the spirit, and we lost that in the fall. And so what the spiritual sense does is it restores that original intention that God created the senses for.
Okay, again, I'm going to ask another question that, I don't know, maybe it's off topic, outside your research area, I don't know exactly, but I want to know what you think about the beatific vision and how that might fit into aesthetics and this whole topic and discussion. I think there's been a significant influx of research and interest in the beatific vision over the last 5 to 10 years, so I imagine a lot of our listeners would probably be interested in hearing how this connects.
Yeah, so I would say that theological aesthetics kind of assumes the beatific vision. It recognizes that the happiness of mankind is to see God and to know God and to be drawn to God. So the goal of the Christian life is to see God. So like Psalm 27, I think it is, says, God says, seek my face. And the psalmist responds, your face, O Lord, will I seek. And so theological aesthetics in particular tries to answer the question, how do we seek God's face now? And specifically, what theological aesthetics does is it deals with how do we perceive God's face on the way to glory. So the beatific vision will be experienced in its fullness in the eschaton, in heaven. And I really love one of the things that Balthazar says is he says that in Revelation, the New Jerusalem comes down to earth rather than the church going up into heaven. And so what he's emphasizing there is that a lot of times when we think about seeing God and seeing his face, we have kind of a more nebulous view of, okay, what does it look like to behold the infinite? And I think that what theological aesthetics reminds us is God has created us with a body and with these physical senses. And our sight of God will be mediated through those physical senses. So we'll see Jesus Christ face to face. We'll see the risen Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, face to face. And we'll walk in the glory of God. And our senses in the new heavens and the new earth will function in a way that they were designed to. They'll perfectly, all of creation will perfectly reveal the glory of God. And C.S. Lewis actually has a really interesting discussion of this in his sermon on transposition, where he talks about how the resurrected body will still have senses, but God's infinite, uncontainable glory will be mediated to our physical senses. So it's a mystery in one sense, but to answer your question, yeah, theological aesthetics has everything to do with that vision of God, but it starts to ask the question, how do we see that now, and how does our sense perception work with that?
All right, so the last thing I want to know at this point is, if people want to read more of your work or follow along with what you're doing and the research you're putting out, is there a place that they can go? Do you have a website? Do you have a faculty page? Do you have an academia.edu? What does that look like?
Yeah, so people can access my dissertation at the South African Theological Seminary page. And otherwise, I just recently started a blog, and I've been inconsistent with that. So it'd be foolish for me to say they could keep up with me there. Maybe presumptive, but I'm going to try.
All right. So I think I lied. I do have one more question for you. You recently graduated from your PhD. So I want to ask you, what's the one piece of advice you might give to an incoming PhD student about what to do? Maybe it's something to avoid, or it's something to pursue. We've got a lot of listeners who are sort of in that phase, or a lot of listeners who are supervisors of PhD students. And so just thinking about this, you're pretty close to it, so it's fresh. So just tell me, like, what's the piece of advice you'd give?
Yeah, it was just in June, so very, very recent. I think I didn't know too much about Baltazar when I first dipped into him, and he actually jokes at one point that many dissertations will crash against the rocks of his writing. So if someone says that, you probably shouldn't write a dissertation on that person. just because, okay, so Baltazar is extremely nebulous and hard to get a grasp on. So one suggestion I would make, which I think I did well, was write on something that interests you, that can be edifying, that can feed your soul. And for me, writing my dissertation was kind of like a positive escape from the trials of cross-cultural ministry. And so write on something that will fuel your soul and your delight in God, and won't drain you and won't drain your family. But pick something that is not something that's not nebulous and slippery, which I felt like Baltazar could be at times.
All right. Well, thanks, Ryan. This has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed talking with you about this topic. So all of you who are listening, go check out Ryan's work. Keep up with his blog. Maybe this will motivate him to write a little bit more, having a significant number of new readers. Or, yeah, I guess it would be readers, unless people are listening to the PD, listening to stuff in their car now. I mean, I feel like the AI is doing everything to where people aren't even reading anymore. But that's a whole different discussion. I'm not going to go there. This has been a great time, Ryan. We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about your research, the work you've done here. As a reminder for those of you who are listening, support these people that you find helpful or encouraging. If you've learned something here, if you found something useful, reach out to our guests and just drop an encouraging note. No one's going to ever be annoyed by an encouraging email. Don't ask any questions. Just say, hey, I listened to you on the podcast. I really enjoyed it. I was very moved or thankful or thought-provoked about topic X or when you said this, and leave it at that and say thanks for your work. Those sort of things will really encourage people like Ryan and others, so I encourage you to do that whenever you find something that is of use, even if you disagree with it. If it helped you think about it in a better way, I encourage you to reach out in those ways. No one can ever have enough encouragement, so take the time to do that. I encourage you to do that to encourage others. Anyway, thanks for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.